Hello, and welcome back to Careers Behind the Code. I'm with Amanda Silver today.
Hi.
Let's get started. Okay, so I'm here with Amanda Silver. Amanda, can you tell us a little bit about what your role is here?
I am the director of PM for the Visual Studio family of products.
All right, so tell us a little bit more about this. So when you say the Visual Studio family, like what does that mean?
Visual Studio on Windows, that user experience, Visual Studio for the Mac, and Visual Studio Code. And then there's a bunch of other projects that kind of just roll in there, like tooling for Windows development or the TypeScript programming language, stuff like that.
All right, so I'm excited about this episode because you are our first program manager victim.
Yes.
And so we've kind of done like architect with Fowler. We did like Miguel is sort of like our entrepreneurial sort of multidiscipline leader, but you are our PM exemplar to start.
Sure.
So I want to talk a little bit about like the things that you've done across your career. So right now, like, and I guess we should probably state that indeed your that role is. We're starting today in some ways, right? But you're coming from a sort of long line of roles around Visual Studio, right?
Is that right? I mean, I've worked in developer division at Microsoft since 2001,
and you win. Yeah.
So it's been a while.
Yeah.
And in that time, I've worked on basically every. I've worked on the tooling for basically every platform at Microsoft, from SQL to Xbox to Office to Azure. To Windows as well, Xamarin and iOS. So really everything.
If it's a programming language and you could do it in Visual Studio, you probably had your hands on designing.
Yeah,
it
or just
some point.
A platform, even if it's not necessarily about a particular programming language. Yeah.
Got it. So like in the sense of like with like TypeScript or VB in that sense.
Or? Oh no. So I mean, well, it depends on what you want to talk about. In terms of my career, I kind of started. When I started at Microsoft in the runtime and programming languages. So my first job was to kind of focus on COM interop and, how do you do p-invokes way back in the day. That was like the first, 6 months of my job here, maybe less.
And there's someone today working on p-invokes from VB.
That's right, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And, and then after a while, I kind of started to do just more of the programming language for visualbasic.net. And then from there, it kind of continued to snowball into more and more things. So, I did more programming language, and then I did more the overall, development experience with the editor and the debugger. And then I was kind of like in charge of the entire VisualBasic.net experience. And then after that, then I started to work on Office development and the Office extensibility platform. And it just kind of many, many different dimensions.
So you've taken a like broad generalist sort of thing. You've done deep in certain verticals, and then you've kind of gone and take broad
I've done deep in programming languages, in API design, in code editing experiences and debugging and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then I've also done platform generalist stuff with respect to the various platforms that we enable.
And in recent years, I think a lot of your focus has been more on cultural stuff, like trying to drive culture through the
team? I think that's one, you talked about how I'm the first PM victim that you have on this show. Like, in a way, it's kind of like, well, what is the PM role about?
Yeah.
And to me, I think about my job as half anthropology. Because I'm basically studying developers and kind of how they use tools and how they use tools efficiently and how they use tools inefficiently and, what motivates them to do things and half craftsmanship because I'm constantly studying kind of how they do it and then trying to figure out how do we refine that. And so I think a lot of what I've done in any one of these roles is that I've always tried to bring the customer's perspective to the conversation.
I love the anthropology metaphor. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and so like, while there might be other folks in the room who are literally typing the code that does the thing that we agree should work, I'm the person who kind of, and my team are the people who go and find the use cases and say whether or not this will actually work for a real life customer that's out there or not.
Great. And let's talk a little bit about that. Like, how do you bring customer into the team, right? Like, how do you like kind of lead that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first, we start everything that we might do with open-ended customer inquiry. So basically, we figure out, okay, well, who might be a target customer that we would want to talk to, or a target mm-hmm. user, because not all of them are paying customers per se, that might be using this thing that we're thinking about in the future. And when we start with that inquiry, we don't even know necessarily what we're actually going to build. We might start a conversation with someone about, hey, just what's the hardest thing mm-hmm. that you have to deal with as a development manager in an enterprise, or as a data scientist in an academic research lab? And we kind of, the reason I call it customer-led inquiry is because we go where the customer leads us. So if, for example, they say, hey, look, you know, collaboration on my team is the biggest pain point, right? It's really hard. Then we'll go and dig on that until we figure out, okay, well, this is the very specific articulation of the problem that they're actually encountering. And here are a couple of different solutions that we could maybe explore to address that problem.
Got it. All right, so let's start breaking down how you got to where you are.
Okay.
So right now you're the director of PM. So that means you're like kind of a manager of managers of managers of
in some cases,
of program managers. So you're a manager. B, your discipline is sort of like you focus on program management, and you've done that throughout your career. You've always been a program manager.
Yeah.
So let's walk backwards and let's try to figure out like
from
where
the beginning.
Well, no. Let's go from the end towards the beginning.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
And let's see. Like, what do you feel like was the last place where you had like a major place where you had to make either a decision or where a big change came into your thing? And we'll leave today out of it.
The last change. I think that about 3 or 4 years ago, mm-hmm. we started on a customer-led inquiry journey, and that actually led to a stream of work that's going to occupy us for the next, you know, 5 or 6 years.
By which you mean like an effort that you like sort of was, you think of this as like an opportunity to kind of jump in and learn a new thing?
Yeah, I mean, in a way it was kind of exploring like what's the white space opportunity for development teams
and so it was
how could
like
we address
a
that?
New position than like
it was
new...
less a new position, right? Because at that time I was really just doing you know, the Visual Studio Core product. I was doing Windows tooling, and it wasn't as much about like, you know, we're coming out with this next major version.
Yeah.
What's going to be in the next major version? It was more about what problems are our customers having that we could potentially solve.
So did you see it as like?
I didn't really see it as a pivot at the time. It kind of just felt like let's go figure out, you know, what's being underserved.
And what triggered that the change, right? Like, is it like you noticed something that was changing inside the company? Is it like we got this sort of overall?
I think there were a couple of things. I mean, you know, there's always business dimensions of this, right? And so if we think about the market mm-hmm. specifically for paid developer tools, mm-hmm. It's actually been declining over the past few years. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. You know, number one is with the rise of the cloud platforms, a lot of tools are being, what's the word?
Commoditized?
Not commoditized. There's subsidies by the cloud providers to basically incent users to use their clouds, essentially. And so that's an aspect of it. But also there are dimensions of commoditization where, you know, look, like the experience for doing code editing has been known for, you know, 20, 25 years. And you know, there's a point at which there's a question around like, well, what really is there to differentiate on? And so that's part of what kind of led to this conversation. It's like, well, what are our opportunities for product differentiation? How does the cloud kind of change the nature of what developers need to do. And then also, you know, just thinking about if there's a shrinking market for developer tools, how do we think about, first of all, our share of that market?
Got it.
And then secondly, like, are there opportunities in adjacent markets to kind of think about how our product line could grow?
So it's really, in some ways, you think that it was like the business, like, was really the lead for what you saw as an opportunity to change the way you did your job? Like by the evolving marketplace of where our tools.
Well, sit. It's interesting that you say that, because now that you're saying that, I'm like, no, actually the pivot started even earlier, which is when we started to look at mobile during the mobile pivot.
2002,
I guess this was 2012, 2013.
Got it.
That's when we had just released we had been partnering with Xamarin as an external company, and we had released some tools for Visual Studio Cordova. And I think while they were good tools and they were starting to get adoption, and actually we still see pretty decent traction on both, there was just a question around, we had just done the V1. How do we know we did the right V1? And what would be the appropriate V2? And so at that time, there was a kind of a general movement at Microsoft to become more customer focused. And so what we did is we actually brought the mobile team through a boot camp of sorts to kind of reboot the culture.
Got it.
And so what happened in that is we basically started with customer interviews. We did probably 400 customer interviews that were at least a half hour long in a 6-week period.
Got it.
And just with mobile developers, both our customers and those who were not our customers at the time.
And doing this process is sort of like what gives the seed of the sort of like more broad scaled set of changes that come later?
Is yeah.
That, like,
well,
you kind of learn from going
well, yeah.
That process?
I mean, this was actually something that we did not just with the PM team, but we actually did with the engineering team as well as the doc team. We even brought the legal team and the marketing team with us through this journey, because we really wanted everybody who was focused on how could we create better mobile tooling to really understand the customer that we were trying to target.
And is it fair to say that, like, sort of by, like, getting into the sort of like customer obsession thing at the point where our culture of a company was shifting, that effectively sets you up well for, like, being seen as somebody who could lead in this space, and therefore, like, sort of changes after that point were?
What do you mean?
Like, in the sense of like, well, I'm trying to think about this in the context of how sort of career focus, right?
Yeah.
And so you were there at the point where there was this insight that you started to see about like what the value of this was.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to understand if you feel like that was an accelerator in terms of.
I definitely do feel like that was an accelerator. I think that the thing, you know, you. How do I put it? So there is, I don't believe that I can be super effective by having a kind of directorial, like, go do this approach to my job. I think part of my job is to basically empower my teams to be as smart as they possibly can be and to get smarter over time. And so, what I found, the reason that this is an accelerator is not because I was like, you know, captain of the team or something like that at the time, but because it actually got me to think a little bit differently as a manager about more how do I actually empower my teams to get smart and to basically continually improve our understanding of the customer that we're trying to target.
And in some ways, like, the way you made them more smart is by, like, kind of bringing the voice of the
customer
into their
and actually facilitating this process. And over the past few years, we've really operationalized this approach to the point where, you know, basically any investment that we're thinking about doing starts with customer-led inquiry, and we continually refine it. You know, you almost might think about it as reducing the risk of what we're investing in. It's similar to lean methodologies and other things that a lot of folks in the Valley talk about, but maybe not might not have as much adoption inside of Microsoft. It's a little bit of a different way to approach product development.
That's awesome. All right, so now let's start moving backwards. Okay. So we've got this thing where it's like you're able to sort of bring this information in that sort of accelerates your whole team so that you're able to make these things.
Right.
I want to move backwards from there.
Sure, okay.
And that, like, as we're getting closer and closer, like an early career person could take.
Yeah, well, I mean, so for before that, mm-hmm. I had the biggest pivot before that was that I started working on Chakra. Mm-hmm. Which was the JavaScript engine that powered Edge and powers Edge before this latest kind of strategy switch a little bit. And with that, that's also the time period when we started working on TypeScript.
Got it.
And the reason that I started to work on those things was really a pretty dramatic pivot, which is that I had been working on the Office tooling and the extensibility story for Office. And we had this fantastic pitch to the Office team about how we could improve it. And basically we got some news that it was not gonna make the product, that they had cut it from that version.
The
Office team had cut it from that version of what we were planning to do for that particular era. And so the project that I thought I was working on, which was going to be this massive thing, ended up being a much smaller thing. And so my boss at the time said to me, look, you know, I don't think this is a job that is worthy of your scope anymore. And so essentially saying, like, go figure something else out. And
That's interesting. That, like, almost like gave the opportunity to you to go think about what you wanted to do next. It was a little less like, here's this new thing.
You know, it was never like a you don't have a job anymore.
Yeah.
Like, but it was more like a, look, this just isn't as big of an opportunity as we were hoping or expecting it to be. And so let's go figure out something that's appropriate. And so it just so happened that very same day, I happened to be having lunch with my my mentor at the time, who's Shanku Nyogi, who is now the VP of product for GitHub. And it just so happened that very same day, his GPM for Chakra had left for a competing company.
Oh my.
And so, you know, Shanku was like, hey, does this sound like something that would interest you? And I was like, all right, sure, let's try that. So I did, and
here is the serendipity comes to play. This
I think serendipity has played a massive role in my career for sure.
Ironically, as I'm learning from these conversations, like as I'm starting to have done enough that I can start to see some patterns. It's funny how often the answer is, well, there was this reorg.
Yeah. Or, I think
it's not like the reorg makes it good. It's just that the reorg kind of releases some sort of energy that allows the person to find.
Right.
The kind of opportunity that would develop them to the next level.
For sure. And in this case, it was not a reorg per se. It was just that there was a canceling of one project and basically
direction
a departure of another one. And so for me, even though the team didn't really change, for me individually, that was a big pivot.
Got it.
Because I had been a .NET person before that, and all of a sudden I'm in the JavaScript world, and I didn't really know a ton about JavaScript at the time.
Got it.
Yeah.
So, like, what did you, and so at that point, did you feel like, was that the first time where you felt like you'd made a major like shift away from, we talked about how you had that sort of like VB.NET was sort of your the place where you had specialization. Is that the point where you'd made the decision to be more of a generalist based on the opportunity, or did you feel like you'd already done that?
No, that was actually a little bit earlier.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think this was 2009 that I'm talking about now when I started to make the pivot from focusing on
.NET.
On kind of Well, I was really on Office programmability before that. And then I started to focus on JavaScript specifically. JavaScript did play a role in the pitch that we were making to the Office team, but it didn't require me to go like super deep on these are the intricacies of JavaScript and you know all of the dimensions of like of how the community is really different than the .NET community that I was familiar with, how the programming language was obviously different, how there are all these runtime requirements and kind of the role that the runtime played in the operating system. So there were a lot of dimensions that were really different.
Got it. All
right.
Let's keep going.
Keep going backwards in time?
Let's keep going.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before that, there was a transition period where there was a reorg.
Okay.
That was...
Yay!
Yeah, get to the reorg
time.
Get like a
buzzer that goes off.
There was a reorg. And I... Basically, this was in the era when I had been working on visualbasic.net for, I think, 7 years at that point. And there was a decision to basically, rather than have visualbasic.net have one strategy and C# have another strategy, there was kind of a decision that, hey, they actually are all about .net and we should move them both together. And so with that, it kind of meant, you know, look, like Anderson Mads are fantastic at what they do. You know, I don't necessarily need to be involved in that, in kind of, you know, driving the direction of .NET per se, or of the programming language aspects of .NET. So I decided at that time that I wanted to do something a little bit different. And so I decided to move to think about Office and Office tooling.
I see. So is this the one where you would say it's like you shifted away from what you had sort of started on to being able to?
Yeah, I mean, before that, I was definitely a programming language and editing experience kind of and API design kind of. That was really my focus. It was much more on like programming rather than thinking about platforms.
Got it. So at this point, is it the, like, did you say like I want to like broaden the generality of what I do? Was it more like I want to grow my scope in general? Like what was driving how you thought about what you wanted to do next, right?
Let's see. I mean, this was like at least 10 years ago. So it's like hard to kind of
one way to
back.
Think about this is like, let's imagine there's someone there, you know, out there in the ether watching this who's
phase.
Like looking to make, you know, they feel like they've achieved some level of depth. And I feel like one of the things in all of these stories that you've told us, there's this point where you feel like you've kind of accomplished what you set out to do in that space.
In some cases. I mean, what's ironic about the Office story, for example, is I think we still have a massive opportunity to basically improve that. Mm-hmm. And I think we're finally coming around to the chapter where maybe that'll actually happen. So I guess to your question, how did I think about it? I think one of the things that has fueled my entire mm-hmm. career is I'm very motivated by developers generally,
okay.
right? And I actually had a recent conversation with Kevin Scott, who's our CTO, about kind of what drives him, right?
Right.
Because he's obviously like rich beyond. he doesn't need to pay the bills, right? It's just not a concern. And so I was like, well, why are you still doing what you're doing? Mm-hmm. And his worldview is that there's kind of a dystopian world in tech and a potential utopian future for tech. And what he would like to see is that Microsoft plays a role in ensuring that we move towards the utopian future. And we ended up having a really good conversation about that. And, you know, I think that helped crystallize kind of how I think about my personal mission, which is I think that developers are at the center of any technological direction, and that to really ensure that we are creating a world that serves a vast majority of humanity and elevates humanity,
sure.
we actually need to have more diverse set of developers in the world.
And so through kind of like expanding your scope sort of generally in the universe of developer tools that allowed you along that mission, is that the right connection to make? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I ended up, I've always been basically excited about getting up every morning and just working on how I can make developers more productive and better able to express what they're trying to achieve. Right, and so if I am a vehicle for the untapped power of
sure.
all the developers in the world, then I think that's a pretty great mission because, you know, if you think about how magnified that is, right,
mm-hmm.
And and the magnitude of like how amplified that is in all the developers that we're able to reach from the Microsoft tools, like that's a pretty massive force. And
it always amazes me that, like, as far as we know, I think our number is like there's 15 to 18 million professional developers.
24
is our number now. They've been growing. Yeah. And when you say that number, people go, oh, it's small. Like, that's tiny.
Yeah, it is tiny.
Yeah.
But in terms of the world standards,
in terms of what you're saying about amplification, it's like you can touch.
But that's pro devs, right? Yeah. And if you think about non-pro devs or citizen devs or part-time devs, it's probably more in the 50 million to 70 million range, right? And so that's a lot bigger. But don't think about it in those terms per se. Think about it in terms of the software that they build and who that reaches.
Exactly.
Right?
It's like this. This is the idea that there's a lever, right?
Yeah.
Like effectively, you've found the way that like through affecting their tools, you can make them more effective, which then makes them their customers more effective, which makes their customers more effective.
Right. So in that way, like I think the thing that has always driven me in my career aspirations has been not so much like, you know, I want to achieve some particular title or something like that, but more just like how could I be more effective in the mission that I'm trying to pursue, which is to make individual developers and their teams more productive, and to bring a more diverse group of developers into you know the community.
All right, let's jump forward just a bit, and then we'll wrap up.
Jump
with
back,
oh, but even further back. Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. Timeline problems are huge. Yeah. This is time travel is going to be our late twist in the story.
Is there going to be like a graphic? At the
Yeah. You are here. anyways, how'd you get into this? We've sort of established mission, and we've sort of this idea that like you have that drive.
Yeah.
That's what helps you make these sort of decisions across all of them, right? It's the pattern across.
Yep.
So how'd you get on this in the first place? Like, how did you end up finding that? Did you know at the point where you're picking a job?
It was totally serendipity, right? I mean, I always knew I was a nerd. I came from a nerd family. My dad's a physicist, and my brothers ended up going into tech and you know, nanotechnology and stuff like that.
Wow.
And so I kind of knew that I wanted to do math and science as when I was in high school.
You got that with the morning cereal came in. You guys talk about physics.
And yeah, I mean, like if when we were kids, if we wanted to end our parents' dinner parties, we would make my dad talk about string theory.
Awesome.
And it turned out like the kids were fascinated, but my dad, my dad's friends would leave. So even though many of them were physicists.
That's an excellent exploit. When did you learn to be so manipulative? No, it's great. It's awesome.
Yeah. So I think from there, then I decided to go to a particular university because, hey, they seem to have good, STEM. And then I kind of accidentally ended up in the Computer Science 101 course because everybody said it was really great.
Got it.
And it turned out it was a lot of fun, and there was, a bit of a kind of campy culture around the TAs that facilitated it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of got into this community of CS. And then,
Almost like finding your community in some ways. Like you found this group of
I always felt like an outsider for sure.
Uh-huh.
And there were definitely elements of trying of very trying times that it was a good question over whether or not I should continue in it. But by the time I graduated. I had become a TA to a couple of different classes, and so I always felt there was kind of this weird attitude in computer science about how elitist it should be.
Mm-hmm.
That there should only be, everybody should be a systems programmer, and and really the only true developers are systems programmers. And I always thought that was kind of silly, because just there's such a massive opportunity in terms of the power of technology, and we actually need developers in many, many different levels of the stack.
Yeah.
And so the more developers that we could bring into the market, the better for business, the better for the end users mm-hmm. and their experience, and really the better for humanity if you think that, that technology is impacting humanity at large.
And is that sort of like why you picked program, like you started at program management at this?
No, that was totally, not, I did start in program management. The reason I ended up in program management was entirely, almost random. I mean, at that time, Microsoft would give you like a little form, and I didn't even think I was going to end up at Microsoft. But they gave you a little form, and there were three options with like a sentence each of, you know, this is what you do if you're a developer, this is what you do if you're a PM, this is what you do if you're a tester. And I was like, all right, PM sounds good, so check. And that's what I did, and so I ended up, you know, interviewing for a PM job. So it really wasn't well thought out.
That was a really good sentence. on the checkbox.
I didn't really understand the specifics of what the role meant. Mm-hmm.
And then did you like immediately know that it was for you once you got here and started to get more of a sense?
No, I mean, for a while, when I came to Microsoft, I didn't intend to be a lifer at Microsoft. In some ways, you know, I'm 18 years in now, so some people might call me a lifer. I'm almost 18 years in. I intended to quit after 2 years.
Okay.
Because I thought I was going to be an academic because, you know, my dad was like a lab scientist, right? And that was kind of what I conceived of as a job, right? That is what you do.
It's like your visualization of what being a grown-up is.
Right, like, exactly. Like, you put in your time on some, you know, basic research and hope that eventually it turns into something that is useful. And that's, you know, that's what your job is, right? And so I thought I was going to, when I graduated, I thought I was going to go into, like, bioinformatics and kind of the intersection between biology and computer science.
Wow.
And
very different.
Right. And and so I thought when I was graduating, I thought, well, being a PhD is a long slog. It's like 6 years.
Yes.
And you can end up being kind of, you know, poor during that. You don't get paid a ton at most places. And so I was like, well, you know, all of my undergraduate internships were scientific. They were all at labs or research facilities or other things like that.
More towards the academic side.
And I thought, well, maybe I should try industry a little bit just so that I can rule that out. Plus, it would be a good way for me to earn a little bit of money to basically fund my lifestyle through graduate school.
Aha.
And so I went to the technical career fair with 10 resumes in hand, and I thought I would hand it out to the 10 companies to the companies that would pay me the most in cash. I was not interested in stocks at the time because this was 2000, and it was right at the end of the first dot-com bubble burst. And so I didn't hand it out to Google because they were a startup at the time, and I was like, well, they're going to go under. Like, I don't want to work there, right?
So I
handed it to Microsoft, I handed it to GE, and I handed it to Goldman Sachs. And I ended up in the next phase of interviews for each one of them. And for a variety of reasons, I definitely didn't want to work at GE or Goldman Sachs. Microsoft was interesting in part because they really tapped in on that TA angle and kind of understood my mission from the get-go and actually pitched the job to me based on that mission. That was like a big selling factor. And then in the end, it was between Microsoft and my friend's startup in Providence. And my friend really was making a strong pitch to me. And I was intrigued. But the reason that I decided not to go for his role was because even though the salaries would have been the same, actually, he wanted me to start before I graduated. He wanted me to pull super long hours. And it was in Providence, which I had been in for 4 years, and I was ready to, like, move cities. Yeah. And so, you know, Microsoft was in Seattle, they gave me a signing bonus so I could, you know, go to Europe with my friend.
Nice.
Before I started, and they didn't need me to start until August. And so I was like, sure. I mean, given that
sold.
I was only thinking about this as like some kind
money
of
in the
cash.
Short term.
Yeah. And not a career. I was not thinking about this as the start of my career. I was thinking about this as basically like a little bit of cash to pad my lifestyle.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right. So across this long journey that we've gone on together, do you feel like you got really good career advice at any point along the way that you want to particularly pass along?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think for me, my mission and kind of recognizing what gives you energy and what actually gives you life and purpose has been the thing that has made me excited to come to work.
And is that just what you found within yourself, or did you get that as like advice from some, like, find your mission? Did you have a mentor that did that, that helped you with that, or was that something
no,
you found
actually,
like you discovered
yourself?
No, actually,
I think I did discover it myself, and ironically, like, it probably was in the process of interviewing at Microsoft more so
than
anything else. So maybe the person I have to credit for that is Chris Dias, who hired me into Microsoft in the first place.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So I mean, I found that, and I think it just only reinforced over time, and especially as you get into the years when, you know, I have two kids, and you know, it crosses your mind about like, well, should I be spending more time with my kids? Should I be spending more time at work? And like, you know, it's you have to sometimes make decisions about like, am I motivated enough to
trade off instead of
to
just
miss a couple hours with my kids to go to work on something? And I think if you don't have a sense of mission and purpose, I could imagine that would be really hard. I don't know what it would look like for me if I didn't have that.
Okay,
I don't know for you. Do you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah? I completely agree. And indeed, like, one of the things I hear, so like, I'm sure you, like, I spend an awful lot of time interviewing people around here, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that is like, I'm usually what we call the ASAP, the as appropriate person, the last person you usually talk to in a loop. And I'm going to go be motivated to do a better job at that part of the thing, because like, you know, I try to do what you said, right? Talk to the people about like sort of what we're doing here and to make sure that like they understand the mission and not just like, hey, this is a job. And now I feel like super motivated to go do that more. Because like, wow, look at that 18 years later or whatever, right?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
What's your mission?
I was like biting my tongue the whole time you're talking about developer tools to not take over the interview.
But like, the same
like,
way, right?
Like it's this thing about, you know, we get to live and breathe them. We get to actually nowadays, like even me in more of a dev role, get to interact with customers all the time. And now, especially in new Microsoft, we get the opportunity to not just have that be capped at the people working on one operating system, that we have the ability to go and nail like
talk to
literally
all of the developers.
Every part of that story and weave them together and connect the dots.
Right.
And like,
Right.
I don't know why you do it here. I always tell people in the said part of the conversation that I was talking about with the interviews, I always tell people, like, you know, if I ever get, you know, kicked out of this joint, like, I will find another developer tools job.
I know, that's what's kind of been so hard for me, is like, I really am motivated by developers every day, right? And I've had other opportunities to work on areas that maybe consumers or IT pros are my audience, and I can't get quite as excited about it, at least not yet. Maybe I will in the future. I mean, like, one example of a way that I can kind of see it expanding is, you know, if I think about that idea that like my mission and my you know, my joy comes from bringing more developers and developers from more diverse backgrounds into the industry. In some ways, programming languages, programming tools are not necessarily the gating factor for access. Right. If we think about folks in Africa, let's say, you know, it could be incredibly empowering to have more network access and more reliable network access. And that could actually play a much bigger impact on the you know, lives of and makeup of the future of developers in the world than, you know, did I design the right Fluent API or
something. It's funny how it's almost like you're still like what you're trying to do is in the funnel of trying to get these people developer tools. Like, what are the things in the way of it? Sometimes it will be other things.
Right, exactly. And so like, I could see myself kind of going and working on things like that. If I really start to believe that those are the true gating factors.
Okay, this is a fantastic place to end. Okay. So I'm totally going to end here.
Okay,
all right,
cool.
Amanda, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me, Steve. Yeah. It's been fun.
Awesome.